It's case number 69232, Jeremiah Bean versus the State of Nevada. We have Mr. Qualls representing the appellant, Mr. Rye representing the respondent. This is a appeal, direct appeal on a death penalty case. Mr. Qualls, would you like to start? Would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so it's this total 60 minutes, so each side will have 30 minutes, and you're reserving 5 minutes of the 30 minutes. Very well. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name for the record is Thomas Qualls, and I represent the appellant, Jeremiah Bean. Bean's intellectual disability proceedings were the most important aspect of this case. For all practical purposes, the proceedings determined whether he would live or die. And considering the decision of the district court on this matter, I want to remind the court that there's a heightened degree of certainty that's required in the review of death penalty cases. There are at least 11 reasons why the district court's decision on the intellectual disability determination is unreasonable. And I will discuss each of those with specificity, but in a nutshell, the decision must be reversed because the district court's either ignorance of or refusal to follow the law, the court's conflated criteria, the fact that the court ignored medical standards, employed wrong tests, cited with speculation, exposed its bias, and overall seemed to misunderstand the process required. When a decision such as this, one that is literally the pivot between life and death, is filled with so many errors and fundamental misunderstandings, this court can simply not allow it to stand. There are other issues in this appeal, the inability to life qualify the jury, the other bad acts, the exclusion of mitigating evidence, but none are as pivotal nor as error-riddled as the intellectual disability decision. The 11 reasons why this court cannot affirm the district court's decision on intellectual disability to begin with, the district court's refusal to acknowledge or apply the SEM, the standard error of measurement, regarding the IQ test. Despite the testimony of both experts regarding the SEM, the district court unreasonably focused on Dr. Weir's testimony that that Bean's baseline score was, quote, borderline. As if the judge could just ignore the fact that with the SEM, Bean's IQ was effectively as low as 68. This finding exposes, again, either the district court's bias or its fundamental misunderstanding of the process and presents the first example of his refusal to follow the law and the standards of the medical community. We know from the U.S. Supreme Court cases of both Hall v. Florida and Moore v. Texas that the court must consider the standard error of measurement when analyzing the IQ under the intellectual disability test. Actually, Brumfield holds the same. Number two, the district court finds, quote, there was a significant amount of other evidence presented which cast significant doubt upon the credibility of Dr. Weir's results and his opinion in this matter, end quote. This finding is hyperbolic at best and is not supported by the record. The court references an alleged scoring mistake on the IQ test, which it then claims makes no difference in the score, but then says there was multiple mistakes on the adaptive functioning test. It says that all these mistakes call into question the results of the IQ test. This finding underscores the unreliability of the district court's decision. There was no error in Weir's IQ test, other than some speculation other than the speculation of Dr. Mahaffey. And her speculation had to do with another speculation that Weir had scored the adaptive functioning test incorrectly. I'll remind the court that Dr. Weir's experience in the adaptive functioning test is vastly more expansive than Dr. Mahaffey's. He had performed over 150 of these adaptive reasoning tests to Dr. Mahaffey's 9.
Wasn't it up to the court to evaluate? There are two different experts in giving varied opinions. Isn't it the court's position to evaluate and determine which one deserves more credibility?
Certainly. And that's one of the reasons I want to lay out these 11, and I can try to speed that up a little bit. But I believe there's ample evidence in the record, both of the court's misunderstanding of the process and or bias, and also Dr. Mahaffey's misunderstanding of the process. And I think, again, that goes to the heightened reliability review in death penalty cases. If you look at Hall and Brumfield and Moore, and there's actually additional cases, it's kind of a hotbed at the U.S. Supreme Court right now, they are delving into these things, and whether it's either under ADEPA or another methodology, saying even these factual determinations were unreasonable under the circumstances. And that's, again, kind of rare for an appellate court to do. But that's, I believe, part of the heightened scrutiny that this court must look at that. And again, that's why I wanted to highlight all of the different ways that these decisions or these approaches are unreasonable. And one of those is that Dr. Mahaffey insists that disorders such as ADHD or aberrant conduct can lead to intellectual disability, and she discounts the intellectual disability based upon that. And what we know from Brumfield, Moore, and even this court's recent decision in Covington, even though it's not technically precedent, dealt with that exact thing and dealt with Dr. Mahaffey's misunderstanding of some of these fundamental concepts in the assessment. The third reason, the district court improperly relied upon Bean's occasional strengths, including some academic scores, in denying his disability. The U.S. Supreme Court has found this to be an error, that emphasizing the medical community standard, which focuses on adaptive deficits and not adaptive strengths. That's talked about, in Brumfield and Moore, and this court touches on it in State v. Covington. Number four, the district court improperly focused on Bean's diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder and conduct disorder in order to discount his intellectual disability. The district court went so far as to criticize Weir. This is really telling. It went so far as to criticizing Weir, his testimony that antisocial personality disorder can cause intellectual disability. He called it incredulous. And this, again, just shows that he doesn't understand the process, because the High Court in Moore and Brumfield have addressed this exact issue and come to the exact conclusion that Weir was advocating. Number five, contrary to both mental health experts' findings that Bean was not malingering on these tests, the district court concocted its own reasons to doubt their findings. The High Court in Moore v. Texas and the Ninth Circuit in Wybara both confirmed that a judge may not choose his untrained opinion over the opinions of trained experts on such a subject. Sixth reason, Dr. Weir's baseline score was 73. Mahaffey's baseline score was 80. And forming his opinion on which to go with, the district court relied upon two wholly speculative statements from Dr. Mahaffey, and I touched on these a minute ago. But the first one was that she attributed the difference in the two IQ scores to attention and concentration, and she speculated, without knowing, that Bean must have been more distracted during Dr. Weir's test. Dr. Weir, however, specifically testified that Bean was not distracted during his testing and that he did not find him to be easily distractible. Mahaffey testified that she thought Weir scored the adaptive functioning test inappropriately, but again, he had vastly more experience in doing these than she did. Based upon her misunderstanding of the adaptive functioning test, she then speculated out loud that Weir may have also made mistakes on scoring the IQ test. She had no proof of this, and the district court relied upon these speculations multiple times. That is an unreasonable decision. The district court relied upon Mahaffey's, The district court relied upon Dr. Mahaffey's statements that Bean had ADHD. I set forth in the briefs, Mahaffey contradicted herself on this, and it's unclear whether there was actual a formal diagnosis of ADHD or if this was just another speculation on her part. But in any case, her statement that Bean had ADHD is contrary to the five other mental health professionals who have treated and or diagnosed Jeremiah Bean. These professionals include Dr. Melissa Piasecki, a well-respected psychiatrist, Dr. Weir, again, with extensive experience in this area of law. His graduate studies involved, you know, then it was called mental retardation, but intellectual disability, and this has been a path throughout his career. This also includes a childhood assessment, which ruled out ADHD for him, as well as the two mental health professionals at Lakes Crossing. So again, relying upon that finding, I think, is unreasonable, especially if you take this in the context of the totality of the circumstances. The eighth reason is the district court erroneously attributed Bean's adaptive deficits to drugs and gangs, inaccurately finding that his conduct disorder led to his adaptive behavior deficits. Again, the court gets the law wrong here. And this is talked about extensively in Moore v. Texas, but also in the other Supreme Court cases, which recognizes that blaming these deficits on personality disorders is essentially putting the cart before the horse, and is an impermissible departure from medical standards. The ninth reason, the district court completely misinterpreted the DSM-5's factor of, quote, cultural sensitivity that must be considered when assessing adaptive functioning. This is meant to accommodate minorities and deal with language barriers. And instead, the district court twisted this into an unrecognizable factor, criticizing both Drs. Weir and Mahaffey because they did not consider a comparison of, quote, drug-addicted gang subculture to, quote, the general population. The court concluded, quote, it surprises no one that a drug addict can't maintain employment, doesn't get a driver's license, drops out of school, and has very little educational experience. Again, Moore v. Texas tells us that this kind of reasoning is simply impermissible. The tenth reason, the district court improperly truncated its analysis on adaptive functioning because of its conclusion on the first prong of intellectual functioning, that his IQ was too high. Hall v. Florida tells us extensively that this is improper and that there cannot be a simple single-factor analysis which cuts off the three-prong test. Number 11, finally, the district court tells us that a significant sub-average functioning did not manifest during the developmental period because of certain marks he received on testing during school. High Court in Brumfeld and more, as well as this court's decision in State v. Cummington, acknowledge that such a factor alone is far from conclusive because those with intellectual disabilities may still perform well in certain areas. And the focus of the medical community, again, is on deficits and not on strengths. Would like to leave in, I have eight reasons to follow up on your earlier question why it's unreasonable that the district, in addition to these, the district court followed Mahaffey's opinions, and there will be some overlap here. Mahaffey refused to include the Flynn effect in her IQ analysis and discouraged the court from using it. The Flynn effect would have adjusted the IQ scores downwards between 2 and 3 points. She says 2, I think her math is actually incorrect, and it's 3, but it's either 2 or 3. What the Flynn effect does is it adjusts IQ scores based upon changes in population IQ over time from the time that the test was developed. The use of the Flynn effect is standard in the medical community. The AAIDD, which is the American Association of Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities, warns that the failure to adjust intelligence scores based upon the Flynn effect, quote, invalidates test scores and may be in violation of the standards for educational and psychological testing. The AAIDD is cited multiple times recently in these U.S. Supreme Court cases.
Should this court recognize the Flynn effect and mandate that the trial court recognize it in conducting its analysis as well?
The trial court did not use the Flynn effect in its...
Right, but should we? Should this court?
I believe that this court should. I believe that's the medical standard, and I believe that is being recognized by the courts as well. Because the courts have repeated...
There's at least three federal courts that don't. What's the rationale? It seems to be a split between federal courts and a couple of state courts, Virginia and Tennessee. I'm not sure that that's a well-recognized position. If this court is to evaluate the Flynn effect, there seems to be competing rationales for doing so. What would be the rationale in this state for this court to do so? It seems to me like there's some concern about the underlying theory of the Flynn effect itself.
I understand that there's a split, and at least my research shows that the U.S. Supreme Court has not addressed the Flynn effect yet. I believe the Ninth Circuit, the Eleventh Circuit, and the Fourth Circuit have all recognized that it is the standard in the medical community, however. And the U.S. Supreme Court repeatedly tells us that we need to follow the standard in the medical community.
Well, the Fifth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit and the Tenth Circuit disagree with you.
I could have. Maybe it's the 11th Circuit and the 5th Circuit. Court's indulgence, 1 second. I can find where that is. I'm going to have to check my notes and I'll get back to you in the rebuttal on that.
Not disputing that there are some state courts that have recognized the Flynn effect and maybe even a federal district court or two, but at least our information and research indicates that that effect has been rejected in the Seventh Circuit, the Tenth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit. So...
Do you have any indication as to why those circuits
This is what I wanted you to comment about. In whether it be in the circuit courts or in state courts that have rejected it, I want to get to the fundamental rationale. This is not a comparative effort. What is the legal reasoning or the medical science that supports this as part of the IQ analysis? Why should this court venture into this area and mandate it for our trial courts to consider and for those who testify on these subjects?
Again, I would like to follow up on that, but I can tell you that a good reason for this court to follow it is that the AAIDD says that this is the standard and that to not use it invalidates test scores, and that the U.S. Supreme Court has looked to the AAIDD on a number of issues regarding these intellectual disability assessments. And so that would be my primary reason, is that the courts shouldn't be in the business of second guessing the experts on this thing.
On that point, did Dr. Weir employ the Flynn effect in arriving at his IQ conclusion? I didn't see where that was the case.
No. The idea of his testimony was that the baseline was 73.
Mm-hmm.
And then the SEM takes it 5 points either way. But if you employ the Flynn effect, then that's going to take it down even further. It was actually Dr. Mahaffey.
No, I understand that. You're advocating this court consider the use of the Flynn effect in arriving at these conclusions. But even Dr. Weir, the doctor that was offered by the defense here, didn't do that.
I'm trying
to understand where in the record we would get the basis for adopting this concept in our law. Do you understand my question?
I do understand your question. I don't know that Dr. Weir was asked that question. I don't think he testified
it's not in his reports.
Flynn effect.
It's not in his reports, is it?
Dr. Mahaffey did.
So it's an abuse of discretion for the district court not to adopt something that neither expert testified to?
Actually, Dr. Mahaffey testified as to the Flynn effect, and she explained that, or at least on cross-examination, she testified that the AAIDD did support or advocate the Flynn effect. She explained the rationale for it, but then for some reason didn't.
She also testify that it wouldn't make any difference because it wouldn't put his IQ within the range of sub-average intelligence functioning. Did she testify to that?
She testified that as to her baseline of 80, yes. She did testify to that. She testified that with the SEM and the Flynn effect, hers would be at 73. Again, I think her calculations were wrong, so I would say it's 72. But that's 2 points off. And again, so we're talking about here, if you read the Hall decision, the Hall decision from the U.S. Supreme Court talks a lot about how intellectual disability is a condition, not a number. IQ is, quote, an approximation, not a final and infallible assessment of intellectual functioning. And so that's, again, the reason for the heightened review here and why I'm advocating before this court that it was unreasonable for the district court not to go with the expert whose findings actually put him below the PLMSA line of 70 with the SEM. And there are a lot of factors surrounding that. Again, that's why
I'm glad you brought that up, Mr. Qualls, because my question, additional question, is this. Where the district court, as apparently was the case here, is faced with the low end, if you will, of the range being below and by another expert slightly above. Does that end the inquiry when the district court decides to select one expert over the other, or must the district court continue to evaluate adaptive functioning issues?
I believe under Hall, the district court has to continue to evaluate all of these. Again, because according to Hall, the adaptive functioning can bring down the intelligence part of it. Mm-hmm. And so they've got to be looked at a matrix. And we have to understand that this is kind of a moving target right now, too. But again, I want to point out to which it's not just that he has the discretion to pick which one, but it's we have to look at whether that decision was reasonable or not, and we have to apply a heightened degree of scrutiny to that. If you remember the facts from the Hall case, he was actually diagnosed by one expert with a 71 and another expert with 80 IQ. And so you've got, you know, the factually the two cases are very similar there, and the Hall case really does inform, I think, this court's review and, you know, what the district court ought to have done. The Hull court was decided prior to the district court's order denying intellectual disability in this case. So was Brumfield, although not by very far. If I could, I'll continue on with the factors of why I think following Mahaffey's opinion was unreasonable based upon the record. Number two, as I mentioned, she may or may not have diagnosed Bean with ADHD, but she was the only one of six mental health professionals who came to that conclusion. Number three, she blamed ADHD for Bean's various deficits, and this is contrary to the current U.S. Supreme Court law. This court recently found her conclusions in another intellectual disability case to be, quote, infirm, where she offered identical opinions claiming the coexistence of psychological disorders discounted a finding of intellectual disability. And again, I'm referencing Covington there. Number five, she has far less experience in performing the adaptive functioning test than does Weir, and yet she speculated that he had performed his tests incorrectly. Number six, based upon her misunderstanding of the adaptive functioning test, as reflected by her insistence that Bean's other disorders caused his intellectual disability, she dangerously speculated that Weir had not properly scored the IQ test. Number seven, the IQ test she gave was slightly inferior to the one Weir gave. And number eight, she reluctantly admitted that Bean's score on her IQ test, taken after Weir's, could be higher due to what is known as the practice effect.
Didn't she use a different test?
She used a different test, yes. I believe that that's standard in the community.
Right.
You want to try to avoid the practice effect as much as possible, but it's a, you know, again, these are imperfect analyses. And so she admitted that, yes, this is a chance. The court is reminded that Bean was only required to prove the existence of an intellectual disability by a mere preponderance of the evidence.
You have 5 minutes left, Mr. Paul. Okay. Do you want to reserve
I'll reserve the rest.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Rye? Mm-hmm. Mr. Rye, I'm sure you have a long presentation. I had one question Mr. Qualls didn't get to. Maybe you could answer for me at least. One of the arguments was that the court erred not denying and not granting a venue change. And, you know, and under our case law, to grant a venue change, you have to show, number one, inflammatory pretrial publicity, and number two, actual bias of the impaneled jury. Now, was there any, like, television coverage you felt or that I know this was in Lyon County, but by the Reno television market, did it, was there a lot of coverage on this? Or maybe you can enlighten me on that issue then before it was brought up before the court.
Yes, Chief Justice, thank you. In this case, the district court did consider the publicity. And there was definitely publicity. I believe there was 9 articles in the Reno Gazette Journal or the Mason Valley News. There was also some television coverage. However, in the grand scheme of things, it was very scant publicity. It would be no different than any case in Washoe County or any murder case in another county. The news coverage was not excessive. In addition, the district court took considerable time with each of the jurors in this case to make sure that none of them had preconceived notions based on any unfair or publicity that may have influenced their decision before sitting on the jury. So based upon that, we believe the district court properly denied the motion to change venue.
Well, these murders occurred in Fernley. So in Lyon County, you also have population centers from Yarrington and Dayton. And also, were there a mix of jurors from different communities within Lyon County? Or do you recall the ultimate makeup of the jury?
Yes, there was a mix of jurors from other communities. The population in the county is approximately 50,000. Fernley is approximately 20,000. And there was a split of jurors from other areas, including Dayton, Silver Springs, Yarrington, and also Fernley.
Okay, thank you very much.
How long did jury selection take?
As I recall, jury selection was approximately 3 days. May it please the court, in May of 2013, Jeremiah Bean went on a crime spree over one weekend. And that crime spree included the brutal murder of 5 people, 2 who were over the age of 60, another 2 who were over the age of 80. The evidence of guilt in this case was overwhelming. He confessed in details to the crime he committed. He received a fair trial and a fair sentence, and this court should uphold the sentence that was imposed by the jury. The district court properly concluded that Mr. Bean was not intellectually disabled. He did not prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he had significant sub-average general intellectual functioning. Without meeting the first requirement, there can be no finding of intellectual disability in this case. Overwhelming evidence supports this conclusion. The state's evidence, Dr. Mahaffey, is a highly qualified, respected expert. Has worked on, at the time of this case, this was her 9th Atkins case. She had performed approximately 100 intellectual disability evaluations for the Bureau of Disability Adjudications. She conducted her testing, in this case, following the standardized procedures. She administered the Woodcock-Johnson 3, a general intellectual ability, which is the equivalent to the full-scale IQ on the WAIS-4, which is what Dr. Weir administered in this case. Mr. Bean scored an 80 on the Woodcock-Johnson. He did not meet the first prong, significant subaverage general intellectual functioning. Dr. Mahaffey testified that if you apply the SEM, the standard error measurement in this case, it would give an IQ range of 78 to 83 at a 95% confidence level. Using classic theory, the range plus or minus 5 is 75 to 85. Mr. Bean simply does not meet the threshold of an IQ of 70, which is significant substandard intellectual functioning. Dr. Mahaffey testified, and this has already been covered in part, in detail about the Flynn effect and how it would not change her scores in this particular case. She conducted other testing and reviewed other information, extensive information. The district court found that her results correlated with schooling records and academic achievement. Dr. Mahaffey provided extensive analysis comparing her results with Dr. Weir's. The same was not done by Dr. Weir. She explained the results and compared the results to independent records, noting that all of the other records were consistent with her results. School records, family and background information, achievement testing, other evaluations. Regarding claims that the WACE 4 is the gold standard, that's probably correct and usually a test that's used in intellectual disability in Atkins cases. However, as Justice Kadish pointed out, the requirement is that you don't do the same test to avoid a practice effect. And the Woodcock-Johnson 3 is one of the accepted tests by the AAIDD. That, along with the Sanford-Binet test, she followed all the requirements to do this intellectual disability evaluation. The defense evidence is suspect in this case. Dr. Weir's own testimony and findings contradicted his opinion that Bean had significant subaverage general intellectual functioning. He testified that Bean's general cognitive ability was borderline range between 70 and 80. This does not meet the standard. Second, Dr. Weir, although a qualified expert, his mistakes were so pervasive that his results could not provide proof of intellectual disability. The mistakes included scoring errors, administration errors, not following test requirements, administering tests inappropriately, making clinical judgment contrary to the test, amalgamating information on the adaptive test, failure to establish a starting level on the test, inappropriate handling of missing data, computer input errors, use of norms not designed for self-reporting. Dr. Weir testified, if I bend a rule, I'll bend it both ways to give benefit of the doubt where it's possible. Dr. Weir's results are inconsistent with the other data. Dr. Mahaffey testified that she could have no confidence in his results based on those mistakes and errors. Bean misconfused evidence and findings regarding deficits in adaptive behavior. And it is, both doctors in this case found deficits in adaptive behavior, and the record's clear on that.
What about the district court's conclusion? The district court's, if this court believes that the district court was incorrect in its adaptation, regarding its conclusion for the adaptive functioning, why should this court affirm?
This court should affirm because the record's clear that Mr. Bean was not intellectually disabled. And the court can look at the record and confirm the findings that there were adaptive behavior or significant deficits. However, those were explained by Dr. Mahaffey on other basis. You can't conflate the other conditions with the intellectual disability evaluation. She conducted an intellectual disability evaluation, just concluded that he was not intellectually disabled. She made adaptive behavior findings that were consistent with other components of her evaluation. The district judge also did the third prong of the test to determine whether there was onset prior to age 18. And in the district judge's order, he references that based on information that was contained in the reports and in the evidence presented at the hearing. So this court can affirm because for two reasons. One is the district judge did consider the adaptive behavior deficits in his decision, but properly determined that because the IQ did not meet the minimum threshold, the first prong was not satisfied. So at the end, that decision is proper. Secondly, the district court considered all three factors, and you can get that in the order. So he did not ignore anything. He actually considered everything.
Counsel, did Dr. Mahaffey improperly conflate or tie in the ADHD issues with the IQ evaluations? I think Mr. Qualls made some reference to that issue.
Yes, the state would disagree with that. What Dr. Mahaffey did was explain why he had adaptive behavior deficits. She did not conflate ADHD with intellectual disability. She has done over 100 intellectual disability evaluations, and she understands the process. Her testimony was that Mr. Bean was not intellectually disabled. She explained some of his adaptive behavior deficits based on other issues, including ADHD, which she believed was a proper diagnosis, and then also conduct disorder and antisocial personality disorder. So she was not conflating the two. She was just explaining why does that matter in this case. And she says it matters because there was not significant sub-average intellectual functioning. And so that's how she explained the difference. And the three have to exist concurrently under the test in Nevada law. And that's part of that explanation. She has to clarify that for the district court. That's what she did. She went through each of the factors in detail.
And counsel also raised that Dr. Weir had significant experience in administering this type of testing, and I guess I think I'm hearing more experience than Dr. Mahaffey. Is that true, and what difference does that make, if at all?
Again, the state would dispute that claim. As I mentioned, the evidence is that Dr. Mahaffey had conducted approximately 100 intellectual disability evaluations. And as we know from the law, an intellectual disability evaluation includes all three prongs, one of which is deficits in adaptive behavior. So just by her testimony alone, she has conducted at least 100. The state believes both experts were qualified. The state also believes that the law is clear in this state that the district court makes the decision on what evidence to accept and considers the credibility of the witnesses, all the other information, and that if that discretion is based on substantial evidence, this court should not overturn it. And the record contains substantial evidence that supports the district court's conclusion in this case.
Mr. Rye, I may have misunderstood what you said a moment ago, but I thought you indicated that Dr. Weir's opinion was that the intellectual functioning was in a range of 70 to 80. But I thought the record showed that he had actually concluded after correcting a scoring error in his report that the range was 68 to 78. Isn't that the case?
That is the case, Your Honor, and I may have confused you a little bit. My reference was to testimony. He was asked, where does Mr. Bean fall in the range? And his testimony was between 70 and 80. In fact, his report, when adjusted for the standard error of measurement, did reflect 68 to 73.
Okay.
To 78, excuse me.
All right. So your point is that based on the testimony, even on the low end, Dr. Weir's testimony wouldn't have supported the intellectual functioning disability.
That's correct.
I see. But the report did.
The report did.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. And what was the reason for the difference? Was that raised with him?
I'm not sure that was raised in detail. There were some questions about that. I'm not sure what his rationale was for the difference.
Important difference here. Counsel addressed that?
There were questions to Dr. Weir related to that. I don't remember a specific response to that. It may have been in the record. I don't recall that.
Okay. Do you have the record site where his testimony was 70 to 80?
I do not, but I can provide that to the court.
That'd be great. Thank you.
It looks like it was referenced by the district court on page 4 of his order.
Thank you.
I was looking for Dr. Weir's testimony to that effect.
Sorry, the district court order quotes Dr. Weir's testimony.
Okay.
Bean asked this court to establish a requirement for courts to include the Flynn effect. As was pointed out earlier, Bean did not present any evidence relating to the Flynn effect. His expert did not provide any evidence to support his arguments in the brief in this case, and Dr. Weir's report, as the court pointed out, did not even mention the Flynn effect. Dr. Mahaffey, however, did testify that the Flynn effect did not need to be applied in this case because it wouldn't make a difference in her scoring. Bean attempts to argue the Flynn effect now in an effort to whittle down his score. However, that's just not supported by the evidence. This court should not entertain requiring that district courts consider the Flynn effect in this case for two reasons. One, it was not presented and vetted in the district court. Two, it does not make a difference in this case. The Ibarra case applies. Like Ibarra, the application of Flynn effect in this case doesn't make any significant difference. The Flynn adjusted score would be 78. The fact that the district court did not make specific findings in that regard is of no consequence. The district court considered the Flynn effect and the standard error of measurement as provided during the hearing in the reports and in the evidence before the court. Ibarra remains good law, and this court should not revisit it. The application of the Flynn effect is a case-sensitive issue, and this court previously decided that it should be left to the judge deciding the issue and based on the evidence that's presented in that particular case. The district court's finding that the IQ test results of Dr. Mahaffey are more credible and consistent with other results and evidence presented during the hearing, and the IQ of 80 does not support a finding of intellectual disability. Why would this court vary its prior holding that gives discretion to the judges that hear this evidence that is often conflicting, that is during an adversarial process where there is often an incentive for on one side to score low, on another side perhaps to score higher? Why would this court mandate some reduction without knowing what the facts of the particular case are? It just doesn't make sense. The Ibarra case is good law. And if you look at the rationale for why this court decided not to mandate it in the Ibarra case, the same applies here. The court looked at other information and tests in the Ibarra case. So did the district judge in this case. Looked at schooling records, other achievement tests, GED performance, family information, all sorts of things that all confirmed the IQ score of 80.
Is it appropriate to consider the school records in the context of this part of the test, this one of the three prongs?
Sorry. It is important to consider it. Is it important in the first part? I don't know that it applies definitely to the first part. But as this court knows, it's very difficult. One of the difficult things about these cases is oftentimes there's not an IQ test or an intelligent test during the age of minority. And so you have to somehow extrapolate and figure out, was there intellectual disability or significant sub-average intellectual functioning during the age of minority? One of the ways you can do that is look at grades, test results, high school work, family information, and that just helps to confirm, is your test taken in 2014 reflective of what was happening when the person was prior to 18 years of age? In this particular case, it absolutely is. Being across the board, his achievement tests are inconsistent with intellectual disability. They're very high for somebody who would have an IQ of 70. It is true that some people with intellectual disability have certain capabilities. There's no question about that, but you would not, as Dr. Mahaffey testified, see this broad range of achievement scores and grades and that sort of thing. A stellar student, even in very early ages, you would not typically see that in the case of intellectual disability, and that's part of the record. And so the state's position is that the constitutional guarantee in Atkins were met in this case, and Mr. Bean did not prove by a preponderance of the evidence that he was intellectually disabled. And this court should not reverse or change or modify Ibarra. You should allow district courts the discretion to evaluate the evidence in the cases, just like the district judge here. The district judge considered all the evidence, including the SAM, the Flynn effect, all of the exhibits and records provided by Mr. Bean, all of the information provided by the state, as well as the evaluations of these two qualified doctors. The decision of the district court is reasonable and supported by substantial evidence and should not be disturbed. The credibility determination remains with the district court, and this court should defer to those findings and support the decision. Secondly, Mr. Bean claims that the district court did not allow Mr. Bean to life qualify the jury. Again, that is belied by the record in this case. The standard of review, the jury selection and the questions are at the discretion of the trial court. If there's an abuse of that discretion, this court will take action. What happened in this case is there was extensive time for jury selection. There was also an extensive juror questionnaire that was vetted by Mr. Bean's counsel, and the district court allowed Bean to inquire as to the prospective juror's feelings about imposing the death penalty in a case involving multiple murders and the murder of elderly victims. He was granted wide latitude. The district judge also asked all of the potential jurors questions related to the penalties and the ability of each juror to consider all possible penalties, including life. The Witter case is illustrative in that that case actually upheld a district court's refusal to allow defense counsel to ask a question about facts that related to an aggravating factor in that case. And this court said that's fine. The district court can do that because we should not get a preconceived idea of how somebody will vote in a particular case. And so under the Witter case, it would be proper to exclude that question, but that's not what the district court judge did. In fact, the district court judge allowed wide latitude. And I'll just read two quick examples from the record of it, just a sample of questioning of jurors. The first is Mr. Davies. Mr. Davies was the trial counsel in this case. And he's talking to a juror, prospective juror. And at the penalty phase or penalty trial, you and all the other jurors would be asked to consider the four possible penalties. 50 years in prison is one of them. Life in prison with the possibility of parole is another one. Life in prison without the possibility of parole is one. And then the death penalty, of course. That's what we're here for the decision. Prospective juror, uh-huh. Mr. Davies, right. Would you be able to fairly consider all four of those penalties? Prospective juror, yes. Mr. Davies, okay, great. I'm going to ask you, could you consider all four ranges of penalties if someone was convicted of killing a multitude of people? Prospective juror, yes, sir. Mr. Davies, okay, even like life in prison with the possibility of parole? Prospective juror, correct. Mr. Davies, okay, fair enough. And could you consider all the ranges of penalties if someone was convicted of killing elderly or vulnerable people? Prospective juror, yes, sir. Mr. Davies, okay, fair enough. I don't think I need to read another example, but that is throughout the record. Mr. Davies was given that sort of latitude, which seems to even go beyond what this court required in Witter. And he was allowed to life qualify this jury. Mr. Bean received a fair trial, a fair jury that considered this case. The district court followed the precedent and applied the law correctly, as is established by this court. I know that Mr. Bean asked you to adopt a different standard. However, the district court had no concept of that standard. The district court allowed wide latitude to defense counsel to make sure that they were allowed to inquire in areas that they wanted to inquire regarding life qualification of this jury. And that was done. For that reason, the district courts and the jury selection in this case should be upheld. The next issue raised by Mr. Bean is that evidence of drug use was improperly admitted. The reality in this case is the drug use was essential to the case. Mr. Bean was broke, out of money, and decided, I'm tired of being broke. I want a party. I'm going to go steal some money and party. And that's what happened, and that's what the evidence was in this case. And there was testimony throughout the case of how he stole money. And just a brief summary of the case, which is included in the facts in the state's brief, is what happened on a Friday, I believe it was a Friday morning. Mr. Bean had been scoping out a neighbor, the Pates, Robert and Dorothy Pate. Robert was, I believe, 82. Dorothy was 84 years old. Scoping out their house, he entered the house in the early morning hours, walked into the master bedroom where Dorothy Pape was asleep, 84 years old, execution style shot her in the back of the head. Mr. Pape had been out working in his yard, and he came in and pleaded for his wife's life. And Mr. Bean shot him in the forehead and killed him there, right in his own house, and proceeded to steal jewelry and other items from that house, took the truck, went to Reno so he could pawn that and buy drugs. And that's what the testimony was at the trial. And then he continued over a runner for the next couple of days, going to the brothel, meeting up with his friends, going from place to place. In this case, the evidence of drug use was proved by clear and convincing evidence based on the test results, which were taken several days later, where he tested positive for drugs, and also the evidence that was presented by his friends who testified at the trial regarding him using drugs or buying drugs, that sort of thing. It's part of the rest jest day of this case. It's also, it was uncharged. He was not charged with drug use. However, it was a critical component of this case, part of the intent, the motive. And the state proved that at a Petrocelli hearing. The district court made a proper decision with respect to that. The change in venue has already been addressed. It's just under Gallego, Bean does not meet the standard. There just was not the type of pretrial publicity, as evidenced by the record, that would justify any change in venue.
Mr. Rye?
Yes.
Let me inquire about the defense expert, or the expert that the defense proffered in mitigation that was not permitted to testify.
Yes. Okay. So, and that's ground six in the brief. And so the defense expert was allowed to testify, and it was a gang expert from Southern California, I believe. And there was evidence presented by the defense that Mr. Bean was a gang member at a very young age in Long Beach. And that expert testified extensively regarding gang activity, the effect it had on Mr. Bean, his lifestyle growing up, and actually went far beyond what his scope of expertise probably would be. There was one small piece of evidence that was excluded by the district court. And it's unclear if you read the record exactly what that is, but it appears that Mr. Bean thought it would be mitigation evidence to talk about the future dangerousness he faced in prison. And that is not a mitigation issue. Certainly peaceful adjustment to incarceration is mitigation. The jury found that in this case. But what he said this expert was going to testify to is if you don't kill him, he's going to get killed by the Asian gangs in prison. The district court properly determined that that information was speculative, was not substantiated, and the expert wasn't qualified to testify to it. So it was a very small piece of that expert's testimony that was excluded. It was properly excluded because it was irrelevant, speculative, and the expert was not qualified to testify on that issue.
In that same vein, would a mitigation specialist, so to speak, or expert be able to opine upon, I guess, the effect of confinement on somebody with a unique circumstance? Like, if a police officer, for instance, is going to prison, we know that that's more difficult. Somebody's killed a child or those type of things, that their confinement may be more difficult, even though in this context it went a little further than that. Would that be proper subject of mitigation evidence? On this defendant, this time would be more difficult.
The state would contend that that is not proper mitigation evidence, that terms of confinement are left to the executive branch and cannot be evaluated and considered as part of the case of mitigation. And I think the cases, I'm not sure that this court has specifically addressed that issue, but the cases seem to support that in that there are so many variables on how people are incarcerated, what happens to inmates depending on their sentence, how they're housed, that sort of thing, that it's just too speculative to say and provide information on what might happen to somebody when they are sentenced to prison.
So you don't think that a defendant in a mitigation case can present that sort of evidence basically to let the jury know, hey, a life sentence is no walk in the park, right? They're going to be in prison. It's a difficult life. There's difficult conditions. They're in a small cell. Describe things like that to the effect that a life sentence is a real difficult imposition of sentence.
I think that's different than the evidence that they sought to present in this case. But I would agree that there may be a situation where that evidence might be relevant. However, again, that's typically argument. Typically, that is not an issue that's disputed, and oftentimes, I believe, probably is testified to by prison officials and others.
Yeah.
And so I think, and it depends, again, on the expert's qualifications. And that's probably the ultimate with this particular issue, is that the expert just wasn't qualified to testify to the information that they sought to admit on that particular issue.
And that's because this was a gang expert? Had it been a correctional facility person, then what? I mean, because obviously you could put somebody from corrections on to talk about, whether it be jail or prison, to talk about their past performance in prison and what that entailed.
Absolutely, and they did that in this case. They didn't put on a prison expert. They did put on a jail sergeant that testified to Mr. Bean's peaceful adjustment to incarceration, and that was a mitigating factor found by the jury in this particular case. So it is a little bit different, I think, when you talk about the adjustment to how they'll do in prison as opposed to what might happen to them. Because, again, that's just speculative, and it would be, you would need to have evidence to support that claim. If there was that evidence, which there wasn't in this case, then it might be proper evidence.
But under a confident witness that could testify, it may very well be relevant to what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
So, in conclusion, it is true that death is different, but that does not mean the law is different. This court must follow its precedent when reviewing this case. And this court has adopted decades of law dealing with death penalty cases, thoroughly reviewed these issues, and this particular case should not change any of that prior precedent. The fact is that the district court followed the law in this case. Mr. Bean received a fair trial, and the decision in its entirety should be upheld. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Rye. Mr. Qualls, you have about just under 5 minutes left.
Justice Hardesty, if I could, I'd like to address your Flynn question from earlier. In the Ninth Circuit case of Smith v. Ryan, it's 813 F3rd 1175 from 2016. The court recognizes the Flynn effect and its norm in the medical community, and also cites to the Fourth and the Eleventh Circuits as having recognized it. For the record, the Fourth Circuit case is Walker v. True, T-R-U-E. It's 399 F3rd 315. That's a 2005 case from the Fourth Circuit. And then the Eleventh Circuit is Holiday v. Allen, A-L-L-E-N. It's 555 F3rd 1346. And that's an Eleventh Circuit case from 2009, and they actually reference the fact that without referring to the Flynn effect by name, that they have adjusted or supported the adjusting of IQ scores based on out-of-date norms in previous cases. So the Ninth Circuit does address it at some length there. I want to also, do I need to follow up with questions on that?
No, thank you. I appreciate the input. The Walker case, though, I think was a prediction as to what Virginia law would be, but that's my understanding.
Okay. I want to discuss this because the state mentioned it, and it was in the district court's order. This focus on Dr. Weir's use of the word borderline when he's talking about the baseline 73 IQ test. Dr. Weir also testified extensively about the SEM and explained the effect on that, talked about, you know, that it brings the effective score down to 68. And the district court just acted like, you know, it was like the Jedi mind trick or something. I'm just going to ignore all of that. And he asked him at the very end, like, did you say that he was borderline? And Dr. Weir said, yeah, meaning that, like, the baseline 73 is borderline. And he said, that's all I want to know. And then focuses on that in his written order, again, as if we're not going to look at the whole record and put that in context. So that Dr. Weir's testimony on that is definitely taken out of context and ignores
his whole. Mr. Qual, could you clarify the question I posed to Mr. Rye? I don't understand the testimony that it was between 70 and 80 when the report was between 68 and 78.
I don't remember reading that, Your Honor, that he said those words between 70 and 80. He may have been explaining the different ranges, and between 70 and 80 is considered borderline. I don't know.
The district court quotes him on page 4 of the order as saying between 70 and 80, and then cites page 68, paragraphs or lines 6 through 8 of the hearing transcript. But the report apparently makes clear that his conclusion was after a math error, 68 to 78.
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's hard to reconcile this.
I don't know what the discrepancy is. I don't remember there being any doubt in Dr. Weir's testimony that it was between 68 and 78. That was the range that we talked about, and that, again, why it's significant here. I wanted to address also on the Flint.
Before you leave that, ultimately on that issue, the crux of it seems to be whether or not the court erred in crediting Dr. Mahaffey's report over Dr. Weir. Because if they erred there, then the Flynn effect doesn't matter for Dr. Weir because he was already below. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter for Dr. Mahaffey because it wouldn't have pushed him below. So ultimately, and I think we can agree, it's probably error for the court to substitute its own adaptive analysis for that of the two experts. But the question for me is, why couldn't the court credit Dr. Mahaffey's? Why should we reverse on that basis, not credit Dr. Mahaffey's and credit Dr. Weir?
I would say the 11 reasons for the district court's errors overall, the 8 mistakes that I pointed out that are attributed to Dr. Mahaffey calls into question the efficacy of that 80 number. And if you take that 80 number, you adjust it for SEM, and you add the Flynn effect, you're down to a 72. So we're dealing with 2 points. And that does matter in this context because the IQ, you know, we're really close. Now we've got an expert with a 65, if you take those two into account, and a 72, right? Mm-hmm. That's where we are. And so then discounting Dr. Weir's altogether seems really unreasonable. But again, if you take, you know, we've got 2 points if you consider those two things that even Mahaffey says he's above 70. And then you take, you know, the errors that I point out, these 8 errors, do they account? Is human error responsible for those 2 points? Are we that certain in a death penalty case that those errors I point out wouldn't have dropped her score beneath that PLMSA line of, and it's just 70 or below, right? And again, that's not in the law per se right now. There's still no bright line thing. And Hall and the Supreme Court keep saying, look, this is a fluid thing. This is an inexact science. And that's why we have the adaptive functioning test as well as the developmental test to sort of balance this thing out. So I think the Flynn effect is significant if you look at it in that context. And then again, if you look at least at my argument at why it was unreasonable to go with Dr. Mahaffey, you've got that. And I will point this court again, especially this end of the court, to the Covington decision in which you acknowledged similar issues with Dr. Mahaffey in this context.
Thank you, Mr. Qualls. Mr. Rye, thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate it very much. The court will take this case under submission and we'll be in recess to our next